You're listening to the Politics in Action Report at CJMQ 88.9 FM. I am Emily, bringing you up to speed with the latest Canadian political news. On this segment's report, the Quebec government is decentralizing its role setting tuition rates for Quebec universities, countless complaints of Canadians' experience with airport security, plus what's up with the Ontario provincial election, and stay tuned for why Canada has severed its ties with Venezuela, and BC is now suing Alberta amid the Trans Mountain Pipeline dispute. I will begin my segment with news on the provincial front. Starting in the fall of 2019, Quebec universities will be permitted to enact their own tuition rates on international students. The purpose is to ultimately increase the revenue of Quebec universities, paired with the Quebec government's financing to Quebec universities will now have leeway to manage their fund accumulation via international students' paid tuition. If Quebec universities decide they would like a higher tax rate on international students, they now can do so without restriction. The highest amount of tuition paid by students studying in Quebec is actually international students, excluding the French, who pay on average anywhere between $19,000 to $37,000 a semester as weighted from each Quebec university. So this is an opportunity to acquire positive gains from international attendance. Not only that, but after some years of saving on the part of the Quebec government is able to offer a cushion fund for Quebec universities. The Quebec government has designated $6.3 million to smaller universities for the reason the cost for students, especially foreign, will be all the more greater considering the smaller scale of attendance compared to Quebec's larger universities such as McGill University. This is with reason that Bishop's University will receive an 18.1% increase in provincial funding compared to the provincial funding it received in 2016. Aside from this provincial funding, Quebec is granting universities the authority to set their own tuition rates for international students so as to manage their own finances. So Quebec universities, despite receiving this funding, can raise the tuition on international students if they feel they are falling short of making a profit. This is actually a greater responsibility than one might think, because now the universities will take the blame if international students are displeased with the higher tuition rates. Given the Quebec government was previously scorned for proposing to increase the tuition back in 2012, the Quebec government has given the authority to change its tuition rates to universities because they no longer want to be accountable for this factor. So this is the Quebec government's way of decentralizing its role within the education sector. With this new responsibility, Quebec universities are expected to play around with tuition fees for given programs. An example provided by the Montreal Gazette states that international students in the engineering program at McGill University can pay up to $40,000 annually for their studies. The variations of tuition by program is simply because certain programs require fees for utilizing laboratory tools, software programs, or other tools specified to an academic program. It is for this reason universities can add these additional charges to a student's tuition. So there is also this factor to consider in setting the tuition price. This may be less of a concern for modifying international tuition by Francophone universities, because the Quebec government has plans to specifically subsidize so as to increase the amount of international students studying at Francophone universities. With this subsidy, the burden of tuition would already be mostly covered by the provincial government. It is understood that Quebec upholds the Francophone language. However, I do have to say that while studying in an alternative language is beneficial, not all international students possess this skill or well rehearsed in the French language. It is also relevant to consider the fact that these are international students. While studying in Quebec universities, this does not necessarily imply they have plans to stay in the province or in Canada as a whole. So I can see this subsidy benefiting those international students who are from a country that is well rehearsed in the French language, but not necessarily those who even want to learn the French language, based on personal anecdotes from international students who wanted to apprehend the French language. They don't necessarily want to jump in the deep end, so to speak, right off. So they stick their toe in the water to begin. So what I'm trying to say is they want to learn French, but don't feel comfortable integrating directly in a French community. It is often the case that they enroll in English universities and gradually become rehearsed in the French language and learn it on their own time. And I think this is the reason, in part, why Quebec's three English universities have high attendance rates. For example, Bishop's University has seen an increase in incoming students over the past few years. Bishop saw its record highest of incoming students, with approximately 900 incoming students, but I can't remember if it was this past fall or the one prior. While English is not the dominant language of the province, they do have an appeal to international students, which is why I believe Quebec Anglo universities won't increase international tuition rates by much, if not at all. This newfound responsibility to universities isn't like politics in the transfer of power to one political leader to another. These are universities that will do what they feel fit and best for their students. Perhaps you, as a Canadian traveler, know what it is to experience airport security. But to some Canadians, airport security could be better. Recent news articles have depicted Canadians' dissatisfaction with airport security, with claims officers seldom show respect and sensitivity to Canadian travelers. This includes behavior and demeanor that entails yelling and becoming impatient with Canadians during screenings. It's a given. Airports are crammed, and officers have to deal with thousands of travelers a shift. But with that, I believe it is effective, if not imperative, for security officers to undergo communication and customer training as they are dealing with the general public. And when you think about it, passengers are customers for the simple fact they are paying for a service that likely trickles down into the salaries of these officers. Officers do have a duty to maintain a level of professionalism, but it would be preferable to have officers that are approachable if ever Canadians have a concern. I do think the professionalism and seriousness of these officers' duty is projected more because of CATSA, which established our current airport security system. So I'll provide a bit of history here just to contextualize some of the components we see currently with the Canadian Air Transport Security Authority, also known as CATSA. Prior to this act, security wasn't so pat down and as intense. The Canadian Air Transport Security, CATSA, was created in 2001 by the Budget Implementation Act as a result of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The objective of this act is ensuring effective and efficient screening of all personnel and individuals who have access to air transportation. Some of the responsibilities of this act include post-screening of passengers along with their belongings, operating explosive detective systems in all manners and at all times, screen personnel who have access to restricted areas of the air travel, and issuing restricted area access cards. This act clearly sheds light on how serious Canada is with maintaining secure transportation. This has been embedded from the governmental level to the officers at the lowest level of this initiative. And often in times in matters of seriousness, it often rubs people the wrong way. Much like Canadians feel like they are being mistreated by airport security. This isn't the first time the security personnel at Canadian airports have received complaints. A few years back, Canadians had complained security officers were both rough and rude. So while CATSA has reviews, not much has changed to improve communication skills, which I have previously stated it's imperative to have communication training to avoid getting such complaints in the first place. My thoughts are, based on personal experience, is that it all depends on the pace of the environment. Going through airport security at Montreal's Pierre Elliott Trudeau Airport is horrendous, while my experience at the Halifax Stanfield Airport was more appreciated. Nonetheless, within the line of duty, it would make the process much easier if officers possess some etiquette. If CATSA reviews are not picking this up, and I mean picking up Canadians' complaints, then Canadians need to drive this message more and louder. After all, Canadians have a right to fair and equal treatment under the law. I would like to take this time to discuss political action occurring in our provincial neighbor to the west. So, for this segment, I will be discussing what's occurring with the Ontario provincial election just weeks away. At front stage and center is Doug Ford. He is unavoidable, from being in every news article online to having his face plastered on the cover of Maclean's. He is the shining star that some Ontarians believe he can truly make Ontario a better province. I'm talking about Doug Ford in the sense that there seems to be this craze about him, in the manner that Wilfrid Laurier had his sunny ways about him and how everyone was obsessed with Justin Trudeau for the 2015 federal election. It's almost the same thing going on with Doug Ford for the Ontario provincial election. Just a few months prior, Doug Ford came into the leadership position on the promise he would, quote-unquote, clean up the mess in his party. Whether this is in regards to the Patrick Brown sexual misconduct allegations, or whether it is an attempt to redeem the Ford legacy following the fallout of his brother and former mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford. I almost think it is the latter. Ford is attempting to wipe the slate clean of his family, since his family no longer has a solid professional reputation. At the same time, Doug Ford and the Ontario PCs are facing allegations of stolen data that was misappropriated to boost his campaign. Ford stated he had nothing to do with this matter, and the real suspect was former PC leader Patrick Brown. So while Ford has assumed the responsibilities as party leader, he is essentially saying, hey, this was the other guy's problem, don't take it up with me. The thing is, though, as party leader, it does become your responsibility to deal with allegations and such problems that occur. Maybe Patrick Brown knew something of this occurring in the past, but as Ford stated, he is to clean up the mess of the party. And of course, this makes for a great opportunity for Liberal opponent Kathleen Wynne and NDP opponent Andrea Harworth to criticize and question Doug Ford's leadership skills. But hardly any of this has seemed to have tarnished Ford's campaign, as he leads in the polls. So what distinguishes these candidates is what they bring with them in the election campaign. So I will highlight some of the relevant policies each candidate and party is putting forward. I won't discuss them all because, as you know, a party platform is lengthy, and I just simply do not have time to read the whole text of each party. So to begin, I will commence with the platform of the current standing Premier Kathleen Wynne. After 5 years in office, Wynne is campaigning on increasing social services such as childcare and healthcare services, which would acquire a great amount of investment spending on part of the Ontario government. Additionally, Wynne would also like to see a readjustment to the tax brackets, so as to rid of the provincial surtax, which is a tax levied on those earning higher incomes. So these are just a couple of policies that Wynne is putting forward. But of course, this is going to be a difficult sell because A, people have suffered from Wynne fatigue. They have been with her for 5 years in office, and already there seems to be a fatigue and there's a desire for change. And B, this is a difficult sales pitch to Ontarians because much of these policies predict a provincial deficit, And when consumers hear deficit, they run in the other direction, which is Ford. Which brings me to the next candidate, fresh-faced Doug Ford, who is campaigning on policies such as balancing the provincial budget. This involves getting rid of the Liberals' minimum wage initiative, augmenting wages from $14 an hour to $15 an hour next year, and instead provide an income tax credit for those who earn below $28,000 annually. This is standard of any opposition party, to scrap policy initiative proposed by the rival party. As well, Ford plans to have hydro bills cut by 12% and take the 25% cut that was initially promised by the Liberals and distribute them to Ontario families. Ford claims he would fire the CEO of Hydro One, which shows you his general attitude towards Hydro One, as he is implying that Hydro One has been getting away from overcharging consumers. I believe a lot of what Doug Ford has to offer is music to Ontarians' ears. This is what they've been waiting for 5 years, as you know, after the wind fatigue. So as an experienced businessman, he is definitely selling his sales pitch, and it's translated with his lead in polls. Lastly, the NDP has augmented leverage in the polls, slowly approaching the more competitive and dominant parties, the Liberals and the Conservatives. As such, Horwath is campaigning on policies such as investing a great deal in healthcare and social services, which is typically what the NDP campaigns on both at the federal and provincial levels. Additionally, Horwath wants to increase corporate taxes as well as on higher earning citizens. In terms of education, the NDP plans to transform student debt into grants and forgive those with interest on their student debt. What this does is soften the debt load for Ontarians struggling to manage their debt. The NDP, as I previously stated, is a party that believes in helping the population as much as they can with social services and relief, which is the complete opposite of what conservatives typically have within their policies. So it's interesting to see two political opponents with complete opposite of the spectrum policies are within close proximity within the polls. Based on what I've observed, and based on the amount of time that is currently running out before the Ontario election, it does look like that Ontario will have a Premier Ford. They once had a Mayor Rob Ford, and now they're going to have a Premier Doug Ford. But what is intensifying this is Ontarians suffering from Liberal fatigue, and chances are Wynne will be spending these last few weeks in office. Consider what happened in the last federal election in 2015. Canada was, at that point, suffering from Harper fatigue and wanted a change in government, hence contributed to the victory of the Liberal Party. We can take this incident as reference as to what will occur in the Ontario provincial election. So it is unlikely Wynne will be taking this election. Ford is driving on the idea of change, hope, and prosperity for the province, and these are qualities Ontarians are indulging themselves in. I just want to point out an interesting fact about this election, and out of all the candidates, NDP's Andrea Horwath has traveled the most within the province of Ontario to scavenge votes. She has traveled approximately 5,315 kilometers. Ford has the least distance traveled at 2,851, which demonstrates he is confident in his campaign and has not covered as much distance. But it really isn't about who is out on the road more or who has covered more ground. What it comes down to is how much each candidate is willing to offer. This can be difficult when party leaders offer providing social services while at the same time claiming to balance the books. Doug Ford seems to be doing a fine job of doing this. I think his emphasis on good rather than what is negative, despite truthful, as Wynne does discuss running a deficit to cover costs of social services, is serving him well in this election. So to end, the question we must ask is, are we ready for Premier Doug Ford? My answer would be, I don't know. I don't live in Ontario. I have my own provincial election to worry about. In all matters of seriousness, it is up to the citizens of Ontario whether they are ready for Premier Doug Ford. The Venezuelan election resulted in a second victory for Nicolás Maduro, who was elected for a second 6-year term in office. Maduro accumulated 67.7% of the vote, which signifies a clear majority. Yet, voter turnout was 46%, so the numbers don't really add up. This wasn't the typical election, as allegations have emerged that votes were bought and the entire election was corrupt. What's even more corrupt is the opposition to Maduro was banned from running, and the election board was run by Maduro supporters. As well, poverty-stricken Venezuelans were promised a reward for voting, which included food boxes and money. This was Maduro's way of taking advantage of the weak, given the humanitarian crisis and the food shortages within the country. And this all began in the years prior, with the reduction of the world's oil prices that cut Venezuela's revenue, which resulted in Maduro undertaking food rations, and as a result, Venezuelans were starving and it was a hunger crisis. And the reason oil greatly affected Venezuela is because one of Venezuela's biggest resources is oil. So this greatly resulted in a drop in Venezuelan national funds. According to an article from the Washington Post, Venezuela depends on oil as it encompasses 95% of the country's exports. All of this to explain the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and how Maduro was taking advantage of the weak so he could maintain and assume power. Free and fair elections is one of the most important components characterizing democratic nations. So all of this does not come without reaction from the international audience. In the case of Canada, Canada has refused to renew its presence by replacing the ambassador following the outcome of this election. Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland announced Canada would downgrade its diplomatic relations with Venezuela, effective immediately. Part of why all other countries are essentially boycotting relations with Venezuela is in part for the Venezuelan citizens and how the state is failing its own citizens. What's relevant to consider in regards to diplomacy is that relations are symbolic, and they can either legitimize or delegitimize a country's decision. Venezuela's socialist government, though, was supported by other seemingly corrupt governments, like Russia's Vladimir Putin, who congratulated Maduro on his election victory. But Canada pulling its presence out of Venezuela also has other implications. It also makes it dangerous for Canadian travelers who want to visit the region, as there will no longer be representation for Canadians within that country. This ultimately makes it harder for Canadians to have representation and contact with their home country if something was to go wrong. Considering Venezuela's lack of political stability, high rates of murder and violence, and the lack of water and food supplies, this has rendered the government of Canada to advise in avoiding all non-essential travel to the country. As Canada has affirmed it is unsafe for travelers to visit the country, in this regard, it would be risky to continue to maintain the presence of a democratic country in a corrupt and politically unstable nation. What we see here is Canada is taking a stance that a nation is as strong as its citizens. As Venezuela's citizens are now vulnerable, Canada is delegitimizing the nation as it stands, which is a nation that is failing its citizens. It appears that the Trans Mountain Pipeline dispute is really heating up. While BC continues to refuse to allow the pipeline extension, Alberta decided it would reduce the amount of exported oil and gas to the province, a decision which is currently being disputed under the court of law thanks to BC filing suit. BC is asserting Alberta's actions have found to be unconstitutional on grounds of the implementation of Alberta's Preserving Canada's Economic Prosperity Act to this particular dispute. In simpler terms, this law is perceived as punishing BC for not supporting the Trans Mountain Pipeline extension. The Preserving Canada's Economic Prosperity Act, Bill 12, allows the province of Alberta to restrict the amount of oil, gas, and refined fuels if necessary, according to the Alberta government. Specifically, this bill trickles down into controlling energy industries, requiring them to obtain a license that would grant them the authority to export oil to outside parties. This bill actually passed recently. Specifically, it was passed May 16th of this year. This bill does raise a lot of questions, such as, does it grant the province too much authority over its resources, or are they solely a provincial jurisdiction and acceptable? But the question in particular to ask with regards to this case is whether it can be implemented in cases of disputes where Alberta feels they are not being treated fairly. Although one thing is certain, Alberta has declared war on British Columbia with enacting this bill. Alberta does have a point in saying the delay of the extended pipeline is losing potential funds for Alberta. Yet, Bill 12 is impacting BC as well. And this is an issue for BC for the simple theory of supply and demand. Ultimately, with a decrease in supply of oil and gas within the province, BC will have to increase prices to offset demand, which will likely result in backlash from British Columbians, for one, and life will be that more expensive in BC as households will be dedicating a higher amount of funds for gas, as well as industries using gas such as transportation industries. This will ultimately hinder BC's economy, as oil and gas are both essential goods without much substitution. The dispute has really made a difference in the pipeline dispute as the May 31st guarantee deadline is approaching. It appears much of these premier's actions are at a standstill until the Trans Mountain Pipeline dispute is resolved, if it will ever be resolved. At this point, is negotiation and compromise possible? It appears we have gone beyond that. These provinces are not being very neighborly, to say the least. And depending on however this dispute is ultimately resolved, it will leave a bitter taste in one province's mouth. All this to say, relations with Alberta and BC will not be the same. Thank you for tuning in for another segment of Politics in Action. I'm Emily, bringing you your national, provincial, and local political news. I hope to see you the next time on CGMQ 88.9 FM.